This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Good morning and welcome to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. For Dr. Richard Schertz, I'm Jim Russ. Going to talk about a lot of stuff today. Among those topics, hurricanes, Morse code, and potatoes. But first...
And now, it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yes. We have an email from Arnie. Hi, Dr. Schertz. As a physicist, can you tell me the physics behind the memristor that HP is developing? I understand memristors are being developed by HP since 2007. Will not be binary, so they'll be able to do a lot more in terms of computer electronics rather than transistors. They'll be able to exist in two or more states, on or off. They may also be useful for analog circuits. How do memristors work from the physics point of view, and what's their potential use in computers and other electronics? Thanks, Arnie. See, Arnie really knows how to get my attention.
Yes.
He brings physics right up to the forefront. Well, in simple terms, a memristor is a resistor that remembers.
Mm-hmm.
Memory plus resistor is memristor.
Ah.
And so the amount of resistance that the device has depends how much charge has flowed through it. So it's an analog type of change, and you could use it as a switch or as an analog device. Now, this effect was first predicted in 1971 by an electronics engineer, Leon Chua.
Mm-hmm.
But Leon didn't do much with it. He just sort of predicted the possibilities. It wasn't until 2007 when Stanley Williams of Hewlett-Packard analyzed this device, theoretically, and actually began constructing them. Now, Williams tried to look at what's the physics of this and how would it work at the atomic level. And they came up with an analytic model of a memristor that consists of a thin piece of semiconductor, which is separated into two regions. One region is highly doped, which means they put an impurity in it. That's called doping.
Mm-hmm.
Then as a result, that's low resistance. And then there is a zero-doped region, which has high resistance, because the doping is what provides conductivity. Now, when a voltage is applied across this semiconductor, it causes some of the dopant to drift from the low-resistance area, where there's a lot of doping, to the high-resistance area, where there's no doping. And that changes basically the resistance of the device. And so, because of the migration of these doping atoms, you basically have a memory, in other words. Now, he put this model into practice, Williams did, by using a doped layer of titanium oxide right adjacent to an undoped layer of titanium oxide. And then he put current and voltage on it, and he found that, in fact, the resistance did change with current and voltage. And when they ran through a voltage loop, it exhibited what they called hysteresis. In other words, the resistance was different on the upswing in the voltage than it was on the downswing, and that's what you would expect for this type of device. Now, what would these possibly be used for? Well, you could actually use them for a switch, because you could have a high resistance or a low resistance, and that could be used in digital logic. You could use it as a form of random access memory, because you see you run current in there and you can remember it, so it could be used as memory. An intriguing device would be an analog application where the memristor would simulate the synapse of a neural network. And so you'd make a neural network in silicon, and of course when a neural network learns, the synapses change value and the neurons become either more strongly or less strongly connected together.
Mm-hmm.
And the memristor would be a perfect synaptic element. So it might be very useful for for analog memory with these artificial neural networks? Well, thank you, Arnie. That was a great question, and you just like to bring me back to my physics roots.
And he, like you said, he knows how to get your attention.
He certainly does. We have an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, I need to purchase some music for an upcoming vacation. As a first-time user, my music needs to be mobile. Now, I just learned about Spotify and have an account now. What is the best mobile device to put into a pocket or purse and carry it around to music and as I can listen to Spotify? But I must warn you, I don't have a cell phone and I don't intend to get one. Thanks. Margaret. So Margaret does not want to listen to streaming music, obviously, if it's not a cell phone. Well, Spotify is actually a great listening option. It originated over in Sweden, and it's been in Europe for quite some time. And it's a different model for distributing music. It's a different model than Pandora, which actually does streaming music. It's a different model than iTunes, which provides music. And it's getting great, great reviews. Now, as a first-time user, you can install a free Spotify application on either a Mac or a PC with the basic unit. And so if you get the basic unit, you can install that free application. In fact, while we were sitting here, I installed the free application on the iPad, too.
I was wondering what you're doing with the iPad, too. Marianne is never going to touch that.
No, exactly not. And so, but I have. She has an iPad 1.
Oh.
I have the iPad 2. And I told her, I said, look, you are number one. So you should get the iPad 1.
You are such the smooth talker.
What do you think?
I think that probably
And I'm
worked.
Number 2, so I get the iPad 2.
You're too good. Does the iPad 1 serve all of her needs?
It certainly does.
Good. Well,
it
then,
certainly
then everybody's
does.
Everybody's happy.
But the thing is, whenever I have it set up where her iPad is synced to my iTunes account. So whenever when I downloaded Spotify here in the studio, it automatically downloaded to her iPad
that's
1 back
crazy.
At home. So that's very convenient. It also means that I can buy something one time
and it goes
on two machines because iTunes lets you synchronize two machines with all your purchases.
I think one of these days we should take a look at your iPod and see what your selections are.
Yeah, I think we just keep that for myself.
Oh, are you embarrassed?
No, it's just too geeky.
Oh, okay, that's all right.
It's too geeky.
That's, we're all about that here.
I know. Well, so what you do, you can, first of all, if you want to, you can download Spotify from the website. You install it on your Mac or your PC. Or like if you've got an iPhone or an iPad, you can go to the App Store and download it. And then you have to set up an account. Now, when you download the application, there's no way to set up an account because until very recently, you had to be invited to get an account on Spotify. So what you have to do is you have to go to the Spotify website and put in your email address, and then 5, maybe 10 seconds later, you have an invitation. So then you set up an account, and then once you have your account, you can log on to Spotify, and then you can select a particular artist or a particular song, and you can start getting streaming music right away. And it's really very convenient. Now, they also support, in addition to the Mac and the PC, they support mobile devices. Now, if you get the mobile device, you actually have to get the paid version of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the mobile devices is really, and I'll get to that later, which mobile devices they select.
Okay.
Now, Margaret's issue, though, she said she wanted to be able to walk around with the music on the go. Now, but she doesn't want a cell phone. So that means if she's out in the middle of Timbuktu, how can she stream music down from Spotify if she's got her device?
Doc, how can she stream music down from Spotify?
That's where Spotify is really quite nice. It actually archives songs on your hard drive as you're streaming them.
That's pretty
neat. And so over time, she will then, and you can select how much drive space you'll allocate to the locally saved songs. Now, the reason they did that was that it's instant on. I mean, and so you could have a good number of songs actually on your mobile device, and then when you lose connection, You just basically can listen to the songs right on, right in the cache that's been locally stored. Now, that is distinctly different than Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is actually very, very convenient. Now, the thing that that I like about Spotify is that you get this. First of all, you get a free membership, and the free membership just basically allows you to play without limitation songs for up to 6 months, and you can just play all that you want. You can flip from one song to the next. Like with Pandora, you actually can't pick the song; you pick the venue, and they pick the song. Like, I couldn't go in and pick a particular song because they pick it, and that was part of their deal with all of the vendors.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, you can actually pick the song and you can play it. Now, after 6 months, your free account runs out. Now, if you basically do not want to pay, you can continue free, but you're capped at 10 hours of streaming per month.
Okay.
And you can only play one track 5 times a month. So if you've got your favorite song, you can only play it 5 times. And so, but if you pay $5 a month, all those restrictions go away, along with the ads, because they'll actually put in little audio ads along mm-hmm. with it if you get the free version. If you pay $5 a month, all that disappears, and you can listen unlimited in an unlimited amount, but you can only listen from your computer. You're limited to the computer. If you want to do a mobile device, which is what Margaret wants,
right.
You have to pay $10 a month or $120 a year, and you can use a mobile device. Now, the good news is that they have Spotify clients that support the Android operating system, the Windows 7 operating system, and the iOS, which of course is the iPhone or the iPad operating system put out by Apple. So if you get a mobile device with an iOS, which is the Apple operating system, an Android operating system, or the Windows 7 operating system, you can download a Spotify client on your mobile device. You can set it up to cache some of the songs. So when you are out of range, now, the device, in the case of Margaret's case, since you don't want to have a cell phone, make certain you get Wi-Fi enabled.
Mm-hmm.
So that way you can just download the songs from your home Wi-Fi account, or you could go to, if you don't have Wi-Fi, I guess you could go to Starbucks or McDonald's and download it using their Wi-Fi.
Right.
And then you just select how much you want to cache on your hard drive, and then you won't have the whole directory available to you, but whatever you've cached you'll have available to you when you're out of range of Wi-Fi. So you can go around and pick a mobile device that you like. That is one of those three operating systems. You'll be just fine. Now, the default sound quality of Spotify is not bad. It varies between 96 and 160 kilobits per second. Now, 256 kilobits per second is nominally CD quality, although to people that have sensitive ears, you can hear the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to really get super-duper quality, you can actually configure this to download 320 kilobits per second. So that's not really bad.
No, but it'll take up more space on your hard
drive. It will
drive.
Take up more space. Now, there is one warning. If you have a cell phone, I would not advise you to start streaming this high bandwidth with your cell phone connection unless you've got an unlimited data plan.
Yeah.
So you might only want to use it around Wi-Fi zones anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes this caching quite nice with that offline mode where you can listen to songs.
So, you said it downloads to the cache of your computer. Can you set it up to download to your iTunes account?
Now this is a whole other story. How can you hack this music and get unauthorized copies of it for your own personal use? I think this is what you're driving at here.
I didn't just say that.
So I did do some research on it because I was curious about that question, and you can go in. These are stored in a particular open source audio format called Ogg Vorbis.
Mm-hmm.
That's open source. So there are tools you can go in and you can pull those songs out of that format and you can save them as an MP3. But it's a lot of work. And so the people that have done it have said it's actually more work than it's worth, and it's probably easier just to go to some site were some pirate base site and just download the illegal song just straight out.
How much is your time worth?
Yeah, so it's probably not worth it. This, by the way, is a great option. It's somewhere between iTunes and Pandora. And I'll tell you, it is a cheaper option. They're up to like 10 million songs available on their on their system. It's actually a pretty good option. I think it's going to be stiff competition for iTunes because if you pay for the mobile device, $120 a year, you've got unlimited songs. Now, and the other nice thing is you can create playlists. So now, suppose that you go to a friend's house and you want to listen to your playlist. You log on to your account there, to your Spotify account at their house, your playlist comes up, you listen to all your music at their house with their computer over their Wi-Fi. Then you go to another computer and do it. So you don't have this Mickey Mouse stuff of having to synchronize computers and copy from one place to another.
The iTunes thing.
Yeah, so it's a lot more convenient. And so you can, and wherever you are, you've got your music. So your music is in the cloud. I think this is a fantastic model, and that was a great email, Margaret, and I hope you enjoy Spotify.
Cool.
Over the years. We got an email from Alex. Dear Tech Talk, I've read many articles on how strangers and others can sniff your network traffic, whatever they want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that what does it actually take to sniff somebody else's network? You know, he's only heard these words, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's not exactly like a dog sniffing around. There's actually some software you use for that.
Yes.
I'll explain it. Now, how do people really do it? I want to understand what they can see and what's going on. I know, now, I'm not trying to do anything illegal.
No.
I'm just curious.
Okay,
Alex.
That's
so let's
how people get in trouble.
It is very easy. There are tools out there that allow you to monitor network traffic. And if you simply monitor somebody's traffic and listen to everything that's on the traffic, either whether it's a wired network or a wireless network, it's called sniffing. I mean, if you just observe a threaded discussion or a blog and never contribute, it's called lurking. So sniffing is the equivalent of lurking, except you're just listening to everything that's on the network. And there's some very easy tools that you can do for this. I'll get into the two tools. One of the tools is used for packet sniffing, and that's if you want to track what's going on the network. And there's also another tool that's sort of related to this. It's called session hijacking. And so it's a little bit more mischievous than just sniffing. So the session hijacking, what happens is that, like if you go to a Starbucks and somebody logs onto their Facebook account, okay, when they log onto the Facebook account, it's initially HTTPS, which means their password is all encrypted. But once they get into the session, it's unencrypted. So you can sit there and you can look at the tracking numbers in their session as they talk back and forth, and you can just jump in as though you were them, and you can hijack their session without even knowing their password or using their password.
Yikes!
It is very easy to do, and actually the software that you can use this is a Firefox add-on called Fire Sheep. And I'd feature this, you know, last year once on Tech Talk when it came out. So you can, if you have a Firefox browser, you download Fire Sheep, and you just crank it up, and then you go to a Starbucks, and it gives you a list of all of the people that have logged on to their Facebook, to their Twitter, to their emailing, whatever it is. And if those accounts are unsecured or unencrypted during the actual session, you can hijack them. So you just click on their name, and bingo, you are them. And so the guy who wrote Firefox, this Firefox add-on Fire Sheep, he wasn't doing that to encourage people to hijack sessions. What he was trying to do, he was trying to say, look, software developers, you guys are making flawed software design. I want to show you how easy it is. So he was trying to encourage the software developers to go encrypt it all the way. Now, for instance, Gmail has done that. You can go into Gmail and you can ask for encryption, and and your password's encrypted as well as the session. So you can't, if you enable that on your Gmail account, they can't hijack that. But a lot of these other sites, social network sites, they really haven't enabled it, and so you can hijack it. Now, the reason that they don't do encryption in the session, it takes a lot of processing power to encrypt all of that. So if they're running hundreds of thousands of sessions and they encrypt everybody, they got to have more expensive computers.
Yeah.
And they're saying, to heck with that. I nobody even knows about this,
yes.
So why bother?
Mm-hmm.
That's why he wrote FireSheep, so more people would know about it. So if you want to just check out how that works, I'm not advising you to do anything improper here, but you can just see how it works. Just download the Firefox browser, then download the FireSheep add-on, and you're up and running in no time. Now, packet sniffing is another deal. This session hijacking, you were at a higher level looking at session-level traffic. You can also look at packet-level traffic because in any kind of network, all the messages are broken up into short packets, and then the computers reassemble the packets to get the overall message. But so you can intercept these packets, and you can look at the headers on the packets, and you can tell what's going on with each packet. Are you setting up a connection, dropping down a connection, whatever you're doing, and you can track what's going on. And so that's a very common way to see what's going on to the network and see what you want to find out. And so sometimes packet sniffers are called network protocol analyzers because you're trying to figure out what's going on in the network, something's not working right. If you can actually look at all the protocols and the packets going back and forth, it gives you a clue on how to troubleshoot it. Now, one of the best packet sniffing software tools is Wireshark.
Ooh, sounds ominous.
I mean, how do you like these names? FireSheep.
Love it.
Wireshark. Wireshark.
Picture some flaming sheep.
Wireshark. Now, actually, you need to have a sort of a basic idea about how networks work. But I have to tell you, a long, long time ago, when I was just learning TCP/IP and all the network protocols, I downloaded a packet sniffer, and I was watching connections being set up and dropped, and I was able to figure out all the network action and what was going on just by watching these packets rolling by on the network. And so actually, it's a very good learning tool if you're so inclined to look at the technology of what's in the packet, what's in the header, where it's going, what it's trying to do. It's kind of interesting. That's Wireshark, and you can download that free. And the thing is, without even knowing much, many times username and passwords are unencrypted. So you could probably see a username and password packet flying by, and you could just pick that up if you'd want. And you can just look for interesting things. Now, basically, now that you know how easy it is to look at these things, and I've sort of given the clue, how do you want to be safe? Well, you want to remain encrypted. And so what you want to do is you want to keep HTTPS active even after your username and password login stage. And so check the software to see whether you can set that up in your preferences so that you'll always be encrypted even outside of the login, and then you will be safer. The packets will still be visible, so they can be sniffed, but they can't be read because they are encrypted.
If you're listening to your radio right now, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2, all in the Washington, D.C. area. Heard worldwide on techtalkonline.com, also on federalnewsradio.com, and learn more about Stratford University, our sponsors, at stratford.edu. More of Tech Talk Radio coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different. With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. This is Tech Talk Radio.
And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Samuel Finley Breeze Morris. His mother probably gave all of those names when she called him in for dinner, and he was like, bad.
I don't think Dad had much to do with that name.
No. Samuel Finley Breeze Morris was the inventor of the single-wire telegraph and the co-inventor of the Morse code used to communicate over that wire.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Morris was born April 27th, 1791, in Charlestown, Massachusetts. Now, the reason I'm going back to this is the first time they had communication over a wire, and that was a precursor of all of our digital communication over wires. And the Morse code that he invented was an example of the first type of software that was used to communicate over the wire. He attended the Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, and once he graduated from Phillips, he enrolled in Yale College. See, back then they called it Yale College. Now they just call it Yale.
Yale, right.
Maybe they call it Yale University now. Maybe it was, I don't know what they, I just hear Yale, actually.
That's all I hear is Yale.
So he enrolled at Yale College. He studied philosophy, mathematics, and the science of horses.
Science of horses?
You know, back in 1791, horses were a very big part of the economy.
Was that sort of like learning how to be an auto mechanic back then?
I have no idea. The science of horses. Now, while he was in school, he supported himself by painting. He loved to paint, actually, and he was actually quite a good student. In 1810... he graduated with Phi Beta Kappa honors. So he graduated, let's see, that would be around when he was 19. So he really sailed right through. And actually he was painting while he was in school. And one of the paintings that he did while he was in school was noticed by Benjamin West, who was an artist in the area. And Benjamin West got in contact with him and he said, you know, Samuel Finley Breeze Morris, I think that you should go with me to Europe and we can help perfect our artistic talent over there. So when he graduated from Yale College, he sailed to England. That would have been in 1811 with the artist Benjamin West. By the end of 1811, after he had done some initial drawing there, he was admitted to the Royal Academy, which was an art school there in England. And he learned the neoclassical arts of the Renaissance.
Hmm.
Particularly, he paid close attention to Michelangelo and Raphael. So he liked that style of painting. So you could imagine most of his oils were in that style. Now, he observed, he actually did a lot of work on anatomy and drawing real life in order to be able to draw people, you know, much like Michelangelo did. And his first big masterpiece was The Dying Hercules, which got very good acclaim. Now, back in those days, how artists made money, they would, say, make a painting or an exhibit, and then they would open it to the public. And back then, you charged 25 cents for the public to come through and look and view your paintings. So he would hope that just on admission charges to see his paintings, he could make money.
Not so much. Probably didn't work out that way.
No, it turned out it didn't. He really wasn't that successful in the box office arena. He left England in 1815. He had been there in England for 3 years, and he came back to pursue his career as an American painter. Now, from 1815 to 1825, he tried to capture the essence of America's cultural life, drawing many portraits, many groups of people. And he was really quite, he was a struggling artist, and his shows tended not to be too successful, because I actually think people in general that were going to pay 25 cents to see art maybe weren't that interested in the neoclassic art of the Renaissance, so maybe they didn't like his style that much.
Possible.
And so he was having trouble doing that. And then he did this, and then in 1830... he decided to go back to Europe to improve his painting skills. And so from 1830 to 1832, he was back in Europe practicing and developing his artistic ability. And actually he was in Paris this time, trying to get the Parisian look. I mean, he's really focused on this painting as a career. Well, it turned out that on his way to Europe, he ran across a guy on the ship, Charles Thomas Jackson, who was playing around with electromagnets. Now, this was back when they were just trying to figure out magnetism and electricity. And, of course, if you take and coil wires around a metal core and run electricity through the wires, you create a magnetic field. And the magnetic field is proportional to the current flowing through the device, and that's called an electromagnet.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So you could actually make an electromagnet, and then you could have two electromagnets. You put power between them, and they'd attract each other, and you could things move around. You could have elements move around based on the magnetic force. And so he saw this guy, Charles Thomas Jackson, playing around with electromagnets, and he got this idea. He said, why couldn't I transmit a signal over a wire and make a telegraph? I mean, this sort of prompted the idea. So he got his initial idea when he talked to Charles Thomas Jackson. And he was so excited, he kind of sketched it out, his idea. And then he went back, and Charles Jackson went his way, and then Samuel Morse went his way. But if you're going to just actually turn an electromagnet on and off, you have to find a way to actually send information. So you had to have some kind of code. So if you turn it on for a long time, he called that as a dash. Mm-hmm. You turned it on for a short time, it was a dot. And so by having a series of dashes and dots, you had to be able to communicate something. So he co-created what eventually became the Morse code.
Aha.
To send over the wire. Now, his initial design that he sketched out on the boat, then he came back and he built it, he just sort of jury-rigged this thing together, could only send a signal a few hundred yards, and that was it. Well, that's actually not too useful. I mean, maybe, I guess you could send it to your neighbor's house, and you don't have to go next door to borrow a cup of sugar. But I don't know, but who's going to want to go da 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 da? If you get a cup of sugar, it's probably easier just to walk a few hundred yards.
Probably, but there are lazy people.
there are. So then, but see, his problem, he wasn't a physicist. You see, that was his problem. So he actually didn't understand.
I knew you were going to point that out because it all comes back to physics with you.
It always kind of like loops around in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So then he talked to this New York University professor who was actually a chemistry professor, understood a little bit of physics, and the name was Leonard Gale. And Leonard Gale showed him how to get a signal to go further. And actually, using Leonard Gale's advice, he got the signal to go 10 miles. That's quite significant.
That is.
Now, you know all Leonard Gale recommended?
What's that?
A bigger battery and a bigger magnet.
No kidding.
Because he said if you need more signal, you got to put more oomph in it.
Yeah.
So that's what he did, and bingo, it went 10 miles. Then they met another. The problem is Morse and Gale really didn't have much money. You see, Morse really wasn't selling much in the way of art. He's what you call a struggling artist. His exhibits, he could hardly get his box office on his exhibits wasn't going well. Yeah, and then Gale was a New York University professor not making much money. So they met another guy, Alfred Vail, who was a young guy who was very energetic, but most importantly, he had money. And that's what they needed in order to capitalize on this thing. And so Morris and Vail designed, they made their first public demonstration of a telegraph on January 11th, 1838. And what they did, they actually transmitted a signal 2 miles. Now, they wanted people to see the signal at both ends. So what they did, they were in this factory, and they just ran 2 miles of cable all around inside of the building. And so they had the transmitting port end and the receiving end together.
Mm-hmm.
But then it went through 2 miles of cable. Now, I don't know, maybe the public could have thought there was a something fishy about this, but
yeah.
It was actually straight up. It was through 2 miles of cable.
Which is all that wire they got over there.
That's right. And so they actually made their first public transmission, and they sent a very famous message. This is the first message that was ever sent on telegraph. A patient waiter is no loser.
Interesting.
A patient waiter is no loser. Well, okay, now they had a proof of principle. Oh, by the way, he filed his, when he got back from that ship ride, he filed a patent immediately. And that would have been, he filed his patent around 1832. The patent was not officially awarded until 1840.
Hmm.
So I'll get back to why that was significant. Because between 1832 and 1840, everybody was violating his patent because it hadn't been awarded yet. So that created a few problems for him. Then finally they had a proof of principle, so they went down to Congress. I mean, when you need money, where do you go?
Congress.
In fact, it's still the same.
I was going to say nothing's ever changed, has it?
It's still the same. When you need money, you go to Congress. So he went down to Congress.
Going to mom and dad.
He went down to Congress, hat in hand, and he got a $30,000 contract to run a telegraph from Washington to Baltimore. And so that would be very, very significant. And the official Baltimore, Washington Baltimore telegraph line was opened May 24th, 1844. And this time he sent another message, what God hath wrought.
That's a little bit more, has a little more gravitas to it,
doesn't
it? Yes,
that's right. Now, he could telegraph 30 characters per minute. And in 1845, then, he formed the Magnetic Telegraph Company in order to connect New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, Buffalo, and Mississippi.
Mississippi?
Yeah.
That's a little random, isn't it?
It seems a little random, yeah. It actually does. Now, he finally got his U.S. patent in 1840, but nobody paid attention to it. And he wanted to get a patent in Europe, so he applied for a patent over in Europe. And in 1847, his telegraph was patented in Istanbul. And the patent was issued by Sultan Abdulmecid, who personally tested the invention. And so the Morris telegraphic apparatus was officially adopted in Europe and in Turkey in 1851. Now, there was another telegraph system being used in England that was a multi-wire system that ultimately was beaten down by Morris. But Morris really had Europe, and he had the U.S., Now, in 1853, obviously this patent would be a big deal. I mean, whoever is going to own the telegraph is going to own a lot.
Yeah.
So it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 1853, the Supreme Court upheld his patent, which was originally awarded in 1840. However, they denied the patent on the Morse code. And that decision was used as precedent on why the courts now will not patent software,
mm-hmm.
going back to the original Morse code case.
Interesting.
Because the Morse code was viewed as the software that enabled you to put information on the wire.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting deal. Morris, actually, in addition to the telegraph, he invented a marble cutting machine that could carve three-dimensional sculptures.
Wow.
In marble or stone. I guess he wanted to be an automated Michelangelo.
Why not? Goes back to his... kick back and enjoy himself.
That's
while the machine
right.
did the work.
Now, what really got him in trouble with his painting career, because most of the commissions in painting were like government commissions. He wanted to paint a panel in the Capitol building. And he was like a political whackball. I mean, he wrote articles where he said that he thought, for instance, that slavery was okay.
That's going to get you in some trouble.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, people say this guy, okay, maybe he's a whack. And so then, you know, this really cut into his commissions. He also was very much anti-Catholic. This was back at the time when. Well, there was a lot of immigration coming from Ireland, so he was anti-Catholic, anti-immigration. He was in favor of slavery.
Don't be a hater. That's all I have to say.
That's right. And he was also of the mindset that the U.S. may have been better off had we still been under Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So he was actually a fringe element politically. And when he started talking about this stuff and writing about all these things, his commissions for new painting jobs began to drop off. So I think his political views hurt his painting career.
Hmm.
And so he never and really what happened when he lost the commission for the panel in the Capitol, that's when he just gave up. He said, you know, I've just got to give up on this thing. And,
yeah.
And then he devoted himself to the Telegraph. He died of pneumonia in 1872. His estate when he died was valued at $500,000, which would be worth $9.14 million today, which
is pretty amazing.
Which isn't too bad. He actually held four patents dealing with the communication of information by signals through the application of electromagnetism. So this is an interesting guy. His dream was to become a painter. He never became a commercially successful painter, although his paintings are actually quite good. I looked at a lot of his paintings. I mean, I had no idea he was a painter. His paintings are actually quite good. But his real claim to fame was the Telegraph. Now, he had two wives. His first wife died after the fourth child. And he was actually down doing a painting commission. And then his father-in-law sent a letter to him saying that his wife was very sick and was dying. The letter showed up 3 days later.
Oh.
And then he went back, and she was already buried.
Oh.
That's when he decided, I need to work on a faster way to communicate. So that was actually one of the underlying motivators of why he did the telegraph.
That's important.
Now, his second wife, he married her. She was deaf and dumb. She couldn't speak and she couldn't hear.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a man of silence, and so I think he just wanted to continue in that mode. And he had four children with his second wife, and he was always struggling to be a painter, and that was his true aspiration, and he never quite made it. But there, all you need to know about William Finley Breeze Morris. The man who developed the telegraph, which was a precursor to all of our digital communication over wire, and who also came up with the first software package to run codes over that wire called the Morse code.
Morse code. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, heard in the Washington area on Federal News Radio, WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFMHD2 Manassas, and WTOPFMHD2 Washington. Hope you're paying attention to Profiles in IT, because coming up, you'll have a chance to win free food here on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, five of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
I'm that guy. And my name is Jim Russ. I'm filling in for the doc today on the program, and more specifically at the moment on the Pop Quiz. Hopefully you as a listener were doing your job and paying strict attention to profiles in IT about Samuel Finley Breeze Morse, the inventor of the single-wired telegraph and the co-inventor of Morse code used to communicate on said device. If you can answer the following question correctly and the first caller through on the hotline with the answer, you'll win tickets for two for fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford University, fine dining on the campus of Falls Church, or in Woodbridge at Cafe Kareem. Now the question is, on the telegraph, the first public transmission was the following message. If you know the answer to that question, call me right now, 877-936-9333. West of Falls Church, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Dial carefully here on Tech Talk Radio.
Okay, this segment's dedicated to Irene.
Yes, dear the, sweet Irene.
Yes, the hurricane of the moment.
Uh-huh.
Now, air flows in a clockwise direction around a high-pressure system when you're in the northern hemisphere.
Right.
And it counterclockwise around a low-pressure system in the northern hemisphere. Now, what causes it to spin like that is what they call Coriolis force, and that Coriolis force is caused by the rotation of the Earth. So when you're in the upper northern hemisphere, it spins one way. The southern hemisphere, it spins another way. Now, I'm going to talk about only northern hemisphere hurricanes because that's we're in the northern hemisphere.
Right.
Hurricanes are areas of deep, deep low pressure, so the winds always swirl counterclockwise around the center of the storm where the eye is located. Now, hurricanes impacting the northeast coast usually have a northwesterly track. They always sort of go up in that general direction. And, of course, you would expect that the wind speed on the northeastern side of the hurricane would be a little bit faster because you're going to get the speed that the eye is moving plus the speed of the rotation. And on the opposite side, it would be a little bit slower because you're going to the two speeds are going to subtract. So, for instance, if you've got a hurricane moving at 14 miles an hour and it's spinning at 105 miles an hour, then on one side, the fast side, northeast side, the winds will be 119 miles per hour, and on the slow side, it'll be 91 miles an hour. So that's why you get different wind speeds depending on
right.
where you are.
Uh-huh.
Now,
different
wind directions. Now, let's talk about the storm surge. You always talk about storm surges. Remember, it's a low-pressure zone. So if you have a low-pressure zone, it means you're not pushing down the water as far because air pressure pushes water down. And so you end up having the water in the middle of the hurricane where the eye is sort of higher. And it could be as much as 10 feet higher because it's a much lower pressure. And so that 10-foot surge of water when the hurricane goes on to land could create a flooding condition, particularly if you are going to go in around the time of high tide.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, You know, they were predicting that they would hit North Carolina at 5 o'clock Saturday. I think they got there early, though. That would have been around high tide.
It came ashore a little before 8 this morning, actually.
A little before 8 this morning. And then they're looking in New York. It'll be also near the high tide area, so that's why they're worried about flooding. Now, the other thing that happens is that on the edges of the tornado, you've got a lot of turbulence, and so they tend to spawn tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
why
they always give you a tornado watch.
Yep. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2, all in the Washington area, worldwide at federalnewsradio.com. Learn more about this show at techtalkonline.com. There you can see outlines of previous shows and listen to all of our shows. You can download them there as well. And you can also send the doc a question. We'd love your questions to be answered here on Tech Talk. Go to techtalkonline.com. Learn more about our sponsors at Stratford University by going to stratford.edu. More of Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. In for Dr. Richard Schertz, I'm Jim Russ, and this is Tech Talk Radio.
Today on the plate, we have potatoes.
Oh, no. Too many carbs, Doc.
That's okay. You know, all of you people on the Atkins diet, just put on the earmuffs because we are going to be talking about potatoes. Now, there are many different types of potatoes, and each has its best cooking method. Potatoes, as you know, are all about starch and water.
Yeah.
The cooking methods control the reaction between the two. Let's take a high-starch potato that's baked. The starch inside the potato absorbs water from other parts of the potato and swells, making a space between the cells and creating kind of a mealy, dry texture. When a potato is deep-fried, pan-fried, or roasted, the starch on the surface expands, sealing the edges in the surface, creating a crisp crust and keeping the interior moist.
Mm-hmm.
Boiling or low-starch potatoes do not absorb as much water, so the cell structure stays intact and the potato holds its shape. Now, there are several potato types. Russet potatoes have a very high starch content with low moisture. These potatoes are used for baking. These potatoes are, when baked, are mealy and fluffy, and they're the best choice for mashed potatoes, too. That's
really?
What I use. I use russet potatoes for mashed. The reason, well, actually, I picked a russet. I like a big potato when I do mashed potatoes because it's easier to peel a big potato.
Sure.
There's less peeling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I can peel more potatoes whenever I use a big potato.
Or you can make mashed potatoes and leave the skins on them.
No, but I don't.
You don't like that?
I don't like
that?
Well, see, if you know those little red potatoes that sometimes they... Oh, no, I don't like that. I like my skins off. Yeah.
You're a traditionalist.
Now, I really am. Medium starch potatoes include Yukon Gold or Yellowfin potatoes. Now, they aren't as fluffy as russets, but have a great flavor. Yukon Gold potatoes especially, they taste a little buttery when cooked. Potatoes with low starch content and high moisture include the red and white potatoes. These potatoes are most often boiled or roasted, so you wouldn't want to take a white potato and bake it, you see, because it's low starch. See, so you've actually got to pick your potatoes carefully, you know. They hold up well when they're cooked. You see, the low starch potatoes, they actually keep their structure when they're boiled or roasted. They're used in potato salad because of their creamy texture. They also hold together after being cooked. They don't fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then, of course, there are sweet potatoes and yams. Now, those are actually from two different tubers. Yams are a member of the lily family.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And sweet potatoes are a member of the morning glory family.
And I thought they were the same thing with two different names.
No, you got the lily family and the morning glory family. In the United States, you're most always buying sweet potatoes since true yams are not available. And there's about all you ever wanted to know about potatoes, especially if you are an Atkins diet person.
So, truly, the lower starch content and higher moisture are better potatoes for you if you're trying to avoid starch and
carbs and stuff, right? But if you want to have go for the taste, the lower starch you tend to boil,
yep.
And the high starch you tend to bake.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio. We'll be back with more right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. This is indeed Tech Talk Radio.
I love the microwave for, like, heating water, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about how the microwave actually works. The microwave operates at a frequency of around 2400 megahertz. Now, what that is, there is a water absorption band that peaks around 2400 megahertz, and you can either go on the high side of the water absorption band or the low side of the water absorption band, and you're actually heating up the water in the food. Now, you don't want to be right at the peak of the water absorption band because all the waves would be absorbed on just the surface. You want to penetrate it, so they're actually detuning it a little bit off the water absorption band. So it heats up the water molecules. Now, what that means then is that when you're heating up the food, it never gets any hotter than the boiling point of water.
That's interesting.
So it never gets hotter than 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that means that there are no Maillard reactions. This is the thing that roasts beef, because a Maillard reaction to brown the beef occurs at 285 degrees Fahrenheit. That's why when you cook roast beef, it just turns gray.
Yeah.
Because there's no Maillard reaction. But it is good for various kinds of foods that actually just cook in water and don't need to go above the boiling point of water. Like, for instance, fish.
Fish.
Fish, which is poached. You can put it in a liquid mm-hmm. there. You can poach it. Fish works very nicely in a microwave.
Vegetables.
You can steam vegetables. That works very well. Eggs really work very well in a microwave. You could actually do scrambled eggs, you could do a soft cooked egg in a microwave.
Now, the danger in overcooking is cooking all the water out of something. Is that the problem with the microwave? Is that how you mess things up?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you cook it till the water completely evaporates, I mean, you could ruin food that way, mm-hmm. I suppose. But it's fairly easy to operate. Now, sugar, you can actually use sugar. You could take caramel and you could add a little bit of sugar to it, and you could add sugar and water, and you can make caramel in the microwave too. So that works well. Oil doesn't heat up at all.
I didn't know that.
Put a glass of oil in it. It won't heat up.
So you can't. You try to cook something with oil, it's not going to work.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's all we have time for this week. Thanks for listening. Back next week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not